to give it to him at that time. Today, I'm going to bring to a close the discussion of Aristotle that we started last week. And then looking ahead to next week, we'll be talking about a new philosopher, still in ancient times, Epicurus. And in the course path, you'll see we have two relatively brief readings from Epicurus that I'll be getting into starting next week. Aristotle wrote on practically every topic, not practically, every topic in philosophy. He wrote on every topic in philosophy, and he wrote on pretty much every topic in science, too. He's got a treatise on meteorology, a treatise on optics, a treatise on weather, on physics, on practically everything you can imagine. So we're just taking a tiny little piece of the universe that is Aristotle. But the piece that we're taking is his idea of what's called, what came to be called, metaphysics. He didn't use that term, but it was introduced as a name for what he was doing in the particular treatise that we're looking at. And the reason that I want to emphasize this is so that you are familiar with this idea. I mean, you hear this word metaphysics, and maybe you think vaguely, I don't know, spiritual, religion, God, something like that. There was a time when it meant something quite specific. And it meant a kind of an ideal in knowledge, an ideal for the scientific life. It stood for a kind of a ultimate science. A science of the most important thing and the most important kind of knowledge that you could have, the wisdom that those lovers of wisdom, those philosophers, were looking for. That was the idea for thousands of years in our tradition, 2,000 minimum. And many of the greatest philosophers in history were great for their contribution to that idea. The idea in recent times, the last century or so, it's fallen a bit from its heights. There's more skepticism now among philosophers and among scientists, certainly, that there could be such a science. But I want you to know that that was the idea for a long time. And we'll see later examples. Spinoza will be the most obvious example of philosophers continuing this tradition that Aristotle starts. So that's what I'm trying to do, to introduce to you this idea of what was this business of metaphysics. Well, the simplest way to explain it is with that strange-sounding formula that I introduced you to last week, being qua being. Qua is just a bit of Latin that basically means as. Being as being. What is it to be? Merely. Just that. No further qualification. When you ask Aristotle that question, what is being? Unfortunately, the answer is a little bit complicated. You can cope with that. It's not too much. What is being? No one thing. Many things. But primarily, centrally, being means substance. So you ask, well, what is substance? Many things. No one thing. But primarily, substance is form. What is for? No one thing, many things. But there's a central case of form, a primary form that underlies all the others. And this fundamental form, this primary form, and therefore the ultimate being, is that of an immaterial divine substance. This one particular substance is the truest, most real being that there is. It's the cause of everything else. Aristotle says it is divine, it is a God, it's the highest God. There is in Aristotle no warfare between theology and science. Instead, for him, theology is the very summit of science. It's where it all comes together. It's what it gives the point to all the other sciences that you study. So you can get to the science of God. Now, of course, when we today, when we hear this word theology, then our mind practically automatically flies to thoughts about the Bible and priests and the church. Of course, Aristotle didn't have those associations at all. And theology, that's a word of Greek. That's his word. That's his language. Theology, theos, God, logos, logic, science. For Aristotle, theology is the highest, noblest science. It's the acme of philosophical wisdom. Aristotle's theology is polytheistic. There are lots of divine beings, but there's one chief and highest divinity from which all the others derive their reality, Zeus, if you will. But Aristotle doesn't call it Zeus. He calls it an unmoved mover. So the first thing that I want to do is to explain, where does this idea of an unmoved mover come from? Why does he introduce this law? For that, we have to take a step back. To know a thing, to understand it, is to know its causes, to know the reason why it is, the reason for being. Knowledge, for Aristotle, is knowledge of the causes of things. To know the sufficient reason, that is, the reasons that are sufficient to explain the being of a thing, to know the sufficient reason for a thing is to know its cause, what causes it to be as it is. Now, when we think of causes today, we usually think of something active. A thing does something, it's active in some way, and that produces change in some other thing. Now, that way of thinking about causes, that's not Aristotle's. That only emerged in the time after Aristotle. Aristotle thinks about causes in a somewhat different and a little bit more complicated way. Causes, for him, are all the factors of explanation. Any factor that enters into an explanation, he'll call that a cause. Causes include everything that's required to understand any phenomenon, to understand why anything changes or is the way that it is. So, for instance, to say that a definition is a cause, to us, or at least to my ear, that sounds kind of funny. You think, how could a definition, a formula in a dictionary, how could that cause something? But there's nothing odd about it to Aristotle, and he would definitely include definitions among the causes. Definitions are part of explanation. If something, suppose something is a triangle, and I ask, why is it a triangle? I ask, what's the sufficient reason? Why is it a triangle? And you'd say, well, it's a closed three-sided figure. That's the triangle by definition. Definition of a triangle, closed three-sided figure. So there, the definition explains why the figure that I'm looking at, why it's a triangle. And so Aristotle would say it belongs to the cause. On Aristotle's account, there are four factors that will enter into any complete explanation, the ones that I've put up here on the overhead. Whenever there's any change, any motion in nature, we can ask, what is the law of this change? What natural law is operating in this change? The answer to that will be what he calls a formal cause. Or we can ask, what's the material that underlies the change? Say, the tree changes color, it's autumn. Green becomes red. But there's something underlying continuity, there's an underlying material, the living stuff, the pulp and the bark and so on of the tree. So that part of the cause, that's what he calls the material cause. And then there's the active agent. What starts the motion? What starts the change into motion? And he'll call that the efficient cause. And then lastly, there's the question, why did it change? What was the purpose? What was going on? Why did that kind of change have to happen? What's the purpose? Aristotle would call that the final cause, or the teleological cause. The Greek word telos means goal or purpose. So I'll use the terms final cause, telos, teleological cause, interchangeable. Now, not absolutely every phenomenon in nature will have the whole set of these causes. For example, there's no final cause for eye color, at least Aristotle didn't think there was. There's no purpose why you have blue eyes and your neighbor has brown eyes. But notice, remembering the language from last time, that eye color, that would not be a substance. Color is an accident of substances. Most things, and certainly most substances, will have the full set of causes. A cause is a reason, and everything has to have its reason. The reasons for things are explanations. And these explanations are deductions or demonstrations. And they prove not only that a thing exists, but they also show why it's necessary that it exists, why it couldn't have been otherwise. There is an example of Aristotle's rationalism. I introduced this word rationalism back at the very beginning of this course. And I said that one of the main themes of all of Western philosophy is rationalism. We saw rationalism in Anaximander. We saw it in Heraclitus. We saw it magnificently in Parmenides. We saw it in Plato. We see it now in Aristotle. Rationalism, in the simplest definition, it just means reason rules. Reason says what's going to be and what cannot be. Everything that truly is must be. That's Aristotle's rationalism. Whatever is, so long as it truly is, it's not just an appearance, it has to be. It couldn't be any different from the way that it is. The things of nature not only exist, they're rational, and that means necessary, inevitable. Now, this kind of rationalism leads very logically to the idea of a supremely powerful being. The ultimate substance, the completely actual cause of everything else. Of course, the usual name for a being that fits that bill is God. In Aristotle, and you have to bear this in mind because you know he lived a long time ago, and some features of his world are similar to ours, but lots of things have changed. In Aristotle, God has nothing to do with religion, certainly nothing to do with what we would call religious faith. For him, God is a scientific fact. It's a rational deduction. We have no experience of God, that's true, but reason confirms that God must exist. The evidence is simply the evidence of motion, of becoming, of change. All change is a kind of motion. And all motion has to have a cause. So the conclusion is obvious. There must exist something that causes motion without itself moving. There must exist an unmoved mover, a cause of all motion, the reason for all change. Origin of all nature. And what else would you call such a being if not God? At this moment where we're at in Aristotle, this is chapter 6 and 7 in book 12 of the Metaphysics, the very last pages of our reading in course. This moment in Aristotle is the beginning of something that will be repeated over and over and over again. We won't see all these philosophers, but if you study more throughout the rest of classical antiquity and into medieval philosophy and in the Renaissance and in the early modern period, every time a philosopher sits down and begins to write or think metaphysics, one of the things that you can be sure that he'll get to will be a proof of the existence of God. Aristotle formulates what's called a cosmological. Now, all that means is a cosmological proof, it's just a label, a scholar's name, for the idea of deducing God as the first cause of motion, the unmoved mover, the universe. I want to talk about this proof in more detail. What I'm going to say is a little bit complicated, and just in case it's not complicated enough, I'm going to put a really complicated overhead up here. The overhead is just to help us now. Don't try and copy it. It's on the Avenue page. You can get it there when you need it. But it's just to help you understand what I'm going to be saying. What I'm going to be saying is my explanation or paraphrase of what you can read for yourself in Aristotle, beginning on page 109 of the course guide. So later on, have a look at what, read that over, and you'll better understand what I'm going to say. But I'll go through the proof the way I'll try to put it in terms that will make sense to you. He's trying to prove that this unmoved mover exists. He doesn't just say it. He doesn't just say, in the beginning, God created the heavens. That's not a philosophical way of proceeding at all. So he's going to try to begin with something that no sensible person can deny. There is change. There is motion. Of course, some philosophers deny that. Parmenides denies that. But most people, I think probably all of us, would say, yeah, sure, of course. There's no problem with that at the beginning point. Something changes. There's some motion. If there's motion, then there's time. Let me begin at the real beginning of this proof with time. Time is imperishable. Now, that's hard to deny because the only way you could deny it would be to say that there was a time when time stopped. That there was a time before time. There was a day after time. It doesn't make any sense to talk about before and after time. So time must be imperishable. It always is. Okay, but what is time? That's pretty obscure, pretty hard to get your head around. What really is time? Aristotle isn't troubled by this. He says it doesn't have to be a hopeless mystery. Time is just the count of change. It's just the number of change. It's simply a count of motion. Time, that's just so many heartbeats. So many ticks of the clock, so many dawns, so many moons. Now, since time is imperishable, and time is nothing without motion, it's just the count of motion, the number of motion, then you can derive your first important conclusion. Motion, too, must be imperishable. Not only does it exist, obviously we see it all the time, but Aristotle said it always exists. It has always existed. There's no beginning of motion, just like there's no beginning of change. I mean, ultimate. The world never stops moving. It never absolutely starts moving. It's always in motion. Time is the count or the number of motion. So what is motion? Well, if I can use the language that I introduced last time we met on Monday last week, the Thursday last week, motion is an accident of substance. Motion is something that happens to substance. It's an accident of a substance. Motions don't exist all by themselves. You don't see some motions floating through the air. Wherever there's a motion, there's a substance that moves. That's what it means to say motion is an accident of a substance. It's something that happens to the substance. Only a substance can move, and only a substance can cause motion in another substance. So if motion is imperishable, then there has to exist an imperishable substance, a substance that cannot not exist, an eternal substance. And it will be the cause of motion and change, which means that it itself must be motionless and unchanging. In other words, eternal. Now this eternal substance, it has to be completely actual, fully actual. That means that it can have no latent, merely potential or unexpressed quality. And the reason is because if there were any potentiality in this ultimate eternal substance, if there were any potentiality in it, then at some point that potential might become actual. But that would be a change, and a change requires a cause. Since we're now dealing with the uncaused cause of all change, then this substance must therefore be completely actual. There's nothing for the unmoved mover to change into. It already is everything that it can be. All its qualities are strictly necessary. This substance cannot be other than it actually is. Well, we saw with Aristotle, we saw that he identifies potentiality with matter. What does it mean to say that something is material? That means it has a potential to change. So a completely actual being with no potency at all has to be an immaterial, no matter. So there's our profile of this unmoved movement. It is a substance, changeless, immaterial, eternal, the cause of every motion in nature. There's nothing hypothetical about this unmoved movement. Although no one has ever seen it, everything that we do see, all the changing phenomena of nature are its effects, and its existence is proved by the simple deductive argument that I've just gone through. Now, this unmoved mover, it causes all motion in nature, all change in nature, without itself moving, without itself changing. Now, that, when you first hear it, that may sound mysterious. How could something cause motion and yet not move? But really, this happens all the time. It's a perfectly familiar phenomenon to all of us. A thing causes us to move toward it when we desire it, when we love it. Anything that we love, that we desire, will cause us to move toward it without its even doing anything. Just being the object of our desire is enough to set us in motion. And that's how the unmoved mover moves all of nature, by inspiring love and desire. This love makes each thing strive after the perfection of the unmoved mover. The fundamental dynamic of nature, the basic engine that gets all those changes moving, which is driving all those changes everywhere and every level in nature, is things trying to imitate the perfection of the unmoved movement. For instance, the movement of the stars. Aristotle believed that the star, all the heavenly bodies, he thought they moved in perfectly circular motions. And he thought there was a reason why that motion should be perfectly circular. The cause, the reason, is that, at least to Aristotle's way of thinking, circular motion is the only kind of motion that can go on forever. Everything, to his way of thinking, his physics is not quite our physics. He says everything that goes in a straight line, eventually it stops. You throw a rock, you throw a sphere, it'll go along for a while and then drop. He thought circular motion is different. Once something gets going in a circle, it never stops. And he thought that the reason why the stars move that way is because the stars, they can't be unmoved movers. They're natural phenomena. They've been started into motion. But they can do the next best thing. They can imitate that serenity of the unmoved mover by moving simply in perfect circles, eternally, forever. It's an imitation. Divine motionlessness. Only an imitation, but that's what they're imitating. The stars love God. And their heavenly motion is their way of worshiping and trying to approximate God. For another example, The elements, earth, air, fire, and water. I mentioned back at the beginning that this man, Parmenides, a couple of generations before Aristotle, invented this idea of the basic elements of nature, earth, air, fire, and water. Everything in nature was some configuration of those elements. Aristotle accepts this theory, and he says that all the things in nature, at least here on earth, not up in the heavens, all the things in nature on earth, they are these configurations of earth, air, fire, and water, and they're constantly mixing. All the earth is transforming into fire. The fire is transforming into water. The water is turning into earth, and the earth back into fire, and all in these great cycles. All this mixing, why? What's the ultimate cause, the final cause, the purpose? There has to be a goal. That's one of the places where Aristotle's thought is most different from ours. He says, there has to be a goal. There must be a purpose. And he thinks that the purpose of mixture is to attain the constancy or the homogeneity of the unmoved movement. The elements will never make it. They'll never be pure fire without any trace of earth, or pure air without any trace of water. But that's what the cycling is all about, is trying to approximate to that purity. One last example of final causes and of the basic pattern in nature of phenomena trying to imitate the condition of the unmoved mover is the reproductive cycle of living things. Aristotle, of course, doesn't know about biological evolution. Individuals perish, but species, he thinks, they last forever. In imitation of that eternal, unmoved mover of the universe. Why do plants and animals reproduce? It's their way of loving the unmoved mover, imitating its eternity. So, by the end of Aristotle's metaphysics, he thinks that he's proved this much about this unmoved mover. He thinks that he's proved that there necessarily exists an imperishable, changeless substance. It necessarily exists. It couldn't not exist. It's the comprehensive reason for everything else that there is. It is alive, and it's happy. Why happy? How does Aristotle know that the unmoved mover is happy? Well, of course, much depends on what you think happiness is. And a theme that will unfold in more detail in the next couple of weeks. The way these Greeks think about happiness, they think to really be happy is to be imperturbable, perfectly serene, tranquil. Nothing can upset you. Nothing can throw you off. Well, the unmoved mover, nothing can move it. Nothing can change it. So it is certainly, rather literally, imperturbable. Nothing could be more serene. And so, to the Greek way of thinking, it's happy. And finally, this substance, it's divine. It's the highest everlasting being, the ultimate cause, nature. Now remember how Aristotle conceived of wisdom back at the beginning of the metaphysics. He said wisdom would be the most universal knowledge. It would be purely theoretical, pure science to the highest degree. And he said that it would be divine, this wisdom would be divine in that double sense. It would be knowledge of divine things. And it would be the kind of knowledge that divine things know. So wisdom now must be, we reach this conclusion, wisdom must be philosophical knowledge of God. It must be knowing this unmoved movement. The highest science, the wisest knowledge is theology, the science of divine being. Aristotle knows nothing about the Hebrew Bible, monotheistic religions. He doesn't know anything about all of that. But when Christianity and Judaism and Islam eventually encounter Aristotle's ideas, his understanding of God often became their understanding of God also. To attain theological knowledge, to have a cognition of this divine substance, is to experience for a moment the eternal condition of God's divine mind. When we think very clearly and carefully about God, the difference between our mind and God's mind collapses. And we enjoy, however briefly, God's own blessing. Our mind, however briefly, becomes one with the divine mind of God. What does this divine mind think? Remember Heraclitus. Heraclitus was that pre-Socratic philosopher who told us that we cannot step in the same river twice. When we talked about Heraclitus, I mentioned his idea of the logos. The logos that links the soul to the principle of cosmic order. He said, one logos rules in all things, and in the soul too. One logos in all things. What makes us rational and therefore human is the same reason, the same logos that makes the universe a cosmos, a rational system. Understanding that system, apprehending it in thought, is the only thinking that Aristotle can imagine as the thought of God. That thought, that thinking of that thought, that is the essence and being proper to God. For God, for the unmoved mover, to exist is to think the idea of God. And if we think that idea, then we too become one with God, at least for as long as we can hold that thought in our mind. Our greatest happiness is time spent thinking that thought and thinking all the other thought that gets you to that thought. In divine contemplation, that, Aristotle thinks, is our highest happiness. In those moments, we attain, if only intermittently, the same condition as the divine mind. And that is Aristotle's definition of our kind of happiness. Our happiness is to be as much like God as it's possible for a human being to be. And the way to realize that imitation of God is by the philosophical pursuit of truth. What circular motion is for the stars, philosophy is for human beings. Their way of worshiping God, of imitating God, of actually becoming as close as they can in identity. He says, happiness extends just so far as contemplation does, and those to whom contemplation fully belongs are truly happy, for this in itself is contemplation, this in itself is prayer. So, now, just to bring this to a conclusion, what is metaphysics? What did Aristotle start and the tradition carry on? Here's just a kind of a summary statement. It's the profile of the kind of metaphysical philosophy that would become a motif in Western thinking. It's wisdom. It's the purest of pure theory, the supreme science. It's the best and highest knowledge. And it comprises two basic components, or two chapters, any metaphysics. One chapter is going to be ontology. That's just a piece of scholar's jargon. Ontology means literally science of being. Ontos means being, entity in Greek. Logi, that's logic, logos, science, you know that. It's going to be an ontology, a theory of being, and it's going to be a theology, a theory of a special being, the ultimate being. As an ontology, it will be a theory of substance. That's the primary being. It explains all the other kinds of being that there are. And in Aristotle, that primary substance will be called form, and form will be identified as the essence of any substance. And then there'll be the component of theology, and that's going to include a proof of the existence of God, a proof of the divine substance. So there's our profile, what this whole business about metaphysics is about. There'll be variations. Hegel and Spinoza aren't exactly, what's the point of repeating Aristotle? The only reason for continuing to do this was because you found some problem in Aristotle, or you thought there was something that he overlooked, or some contradiction as the actual just things. And that's what the metaphysicians did for the next 2,000 years. I want to use the time that I have left to begin to make a small shift. This is where our reading on Aristotle ends. You read the last page of the reading of Aristotle. He just concludes on the note that I did about how great it is to identify your mind with the mind of God. For the next couple of weeks, we're going to still be talking about the ancient world, but we'll be talking about philosophy after those great lives, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. You now know that there was philosophy before Plato and Aristotle. Those pre-Socratic, lots of philosophy, lots of ideas. Also philosophy still in the ancient world after Plato and Aristotle. What's usually called Hellenistic philosophy. Hellenistic, at the very beginning I introduced this term, just a word for the later period of Greek antiquity, period roughly of Alexander's empire. We're going to be talking mainly about two schools of philosophy that emerged after Aristotle. The first one we'll be talking about is Epicurus. I'll get to Epicurus, we've got a reading next time, but I want to explain an important piece of the background that I haven't talked about to this point. Plato introduced the idea that nature is governed by the purposive intelligence of the divine creator. You know, it's so familiar to us. But it begins with Plato, that all of nature is governed by the purpose of a divine craftsman. And this creator, this craftsman, is benevolent, cares about people. That's why it created the world, so we can share in this wonderful world. Plato, of course, like Aristotle, Plato knows nothing about the Hebrew Bible, or Judaism, or Christianity, or Genesis, or in the beginning, and so forth. Christianity is 3 centuries in the future. But that idea of Plato's explains why when these religious traditions finally met with Greek philosophy, Plato was hands down their favorite philosopher. Plato has a message in his philosophy, and it's a message that Aristotle will repeat in his own way. That is, we need to keep the soul in nature. Soul is a vitally important component in any understanding of nature, of the world. A world without soul, Plato would say, and Aristotle completely agreed, a world without soul is just unintelligible. And therefore, to the rationalist mind, it couldn't exist. We talked about philosophy before Socrates. There were theorists of the arche, the principle of nature, and then there were the radical monists, Parmenides, for whom being is all one and the same, without any change. We also talked about a reaction to that difficult monism in Parmenides, the reaction that produced the first materialist theories of nature, Empedocles, I mentioned him a moment ago, Democritus. These first materialist theories eliminate soul as an independent principle. That's what it means to be a materialist. You think there is no soul, or you think the soul is just matter. For the materialist, there's nothing truly and irreducibly spiritual in nature. Everything, even the soul, is just reduced to mechanical collisions of mindless particles. To Plato, that kind of thinking is debased and contemptible. There was a story that circulated back in antiquity that Plato wanted to have the works of Democritus, the first atomist, wanted to have those works burned. Ex extirpated root and branch from the emerging tradition of Western science. That's what Plato thought would be a good idea. Suppose that had happened. Suppose Plato got his wish, the works of Democritus were burned, atomism was forgotten, and we just never had the whole idea of an atom. Suppose that happened. Imagine how different our history would be without that idea. I want to read you the words of a contemporary of ours. He's not alive now, but he was a few years ago. A physicist, Richard Feynman, one of the great post-Einsteinian physicists. Perhaps you know something about his work, quantum thermodynamics. Feynman taught at the California Polytechnic University, and he begins his introductory course, first year physics, with these words. Let me read to you the way he begins addressing his students. He says, if in some cataclysm all scientific knowledge were to be destroyed, and only one single sentence passed on to the next generation, the statement that would contain the most information in the fewest words is the atomic hypothesis. All things are made of atoms, little particles that move around in perpetual motion, attracting each other when they are a little distance apart, but repelling upon being squeezed into them. In that one sentence, there is an enormous amount of information about the world, if just a little imagination and thinking are at play. Well, Plato did not get his wish. He did not destroy atomism. He didn't live to see atomism or materialist theories of nature. He didn't live to see how they flourished in later generations. The greatest of the Greek atomists and materialists is Epicurus, our next philosopher. And he began a school of philosophy that lasted all the way down to the end of the ancient world, and then was lost for all the centuries of medieval and Renaissance until the late Renaissance, when the works were finally recovered and were renewed and began to be studied anew in the West. Epicurus offers a radical alternative to both Plato and Aristotle, while still remaining true to the spirit of Socrates and to Socrates' conviction that the value of philosophy is to take care of ourselves with lasting happiness. Before we talk about Epicurus, which I'll want to get into in detail next time, I need to explain a little piece of the background, though. And that is the difference that the ancient philosophers acknowledged between what I'll call, these are our words to explain something that's different for us, the difference between philosophy and philosophical discourse. We're not used to this distinction, and you may think we don't even need it these days. Philosophical discourse, that's what you read in your text, that's what you hear from me. Philosophical discourse is all the theories and arguments that have been devised by the philosophers. That's their discourse, their words, but it's not their philosophy, or at least it's not all of it. It omits what they thought was the most important part, which is how the philosophers, the teachers and their students, how they live their lives. Their reputation for happiness, for wisdom, for virtue, was so much more important than their theoretical discourse, that all throughout antiquity, famous philosophers, beginning with Socrates, never actually wrote anything at all. Today, we think nothing of studying philosophical writings by Nazis, like Martin Heidegger, or by murderers, like Louis Althusser, or by suicides, like Gilles Deleuze. We isolate the study of philosophy from what? We no longer expect a close connection between the study of philosophy and changes in the way you live your life. We even consider it a fallacy to judge the value of a theory by the character of the author. The ancients would never have accepted that divorce of life and theory. The point of the discourse, the value of all those books and lectures and writings, study is how you live your life. Philosophy is meant to be practice, and its theories are meant to assist practice. Now, back in antiquity, if you wanted to study philosophy, you couldn't just go to a university and just come in anonymously and sit in this class and listen to what somebody says and then disappear and come back if you want to and just be this kind of passive thing. Back then, if you wanted to study philosophy, that meant to enter into a way of life with others in one of the schools, Platonic, Aristotelian, Stoic, Epicurean, other than lots of schools. You couldn't just attend lectures anonymously. You had to find a teacher, make a commitment, be granted entree to an intimate circle of teachers and fellow students with whom you would live and practice philosophy. In the years after Aristotle, there were many such schools in Athens and everywhere that Greek culture spread. Some of these schools were reserved for the noble classes, like Plato's Academy, the Lyceum of Aristotle. Other philosophical schools were open to everybody, men and women, rich and poor, citizen and slave. The school of Epicurus is an example of that, so too the Stoics. Practically all the works of ancient philosophy, philosophical texts that we study, were written for the purpose of circulating in these schools, to provoke interest and give the students something to talk about, to introduce new students to important points of the school's teaching. Epicurus was one of these teachers. He began one of these schools, and it continued in an unbroken line, passed down from one master to another. Epicurus designates, when he was ready to retire, the person who inherited the school, inherited the physical property of the school, and that master then passed it on to another master, a continuous line for hundreds of years, down until ultimately the Roman Empire fell apart. That school of Epicurus is called the Garden. Aristotle had his Lyceum, Plato his Academy, Epicurus had his Garden. It was called the Garden because that's where Epicurus taught. He bought a property outside the city walls. It had a walled-in garden, very pretty, you know, the Greek weather, sunshine, pomegranate trees, lemons, a beautiful, fragrant garden, walled in, quiet, protected, undisturbed. And there Epicurus would sit, his disciples would sit with him, and they would practice philosophy. That's what I want to begin explaining to you when we meet on Monday. The assignments, to repeat, bring them to class. At the end of the hour, please just sit on them. At the end of the hour, my assistants will be up here at the front to receive your assignments. Thank you.